VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the Hong Kong democracy movement and Beijing's treatment of its Uyghur Muslim minority collide with U.S.-China trade talks. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Last week, the U.S. Congress passed two pieces of legislation that have prompted talk of retaliation from Beijing. Congress passed the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act by a vote of 417-1, and the Senate by unanimous consent. U.S. President Donald Trump initially expressed ambivalence about signing it because he was concerned that it would upset Beijing, just as the United States and China are negotiating a trade deal. However, Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair James Risch said the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act is an important step forward in holding the Chinese Communist Party accountable for its erosion of Hong Kong's autonomy and its repression of human rights. Protests erupted in Hong Kong in June over the government's plans to allow some criminal suspects to be extradited to the Chinese mainland. Hong Kong officials withdrew the bill in September, but street protests have continued as demonstrators fear Beijing is preparing to water down Hong Kong's democracy and autonomy nearly 30 years before the former British colony's special status expires. But in another setback for China, the U.S. House of Representatives recently passed the Uyghur Act of 2019, which condemns the detention of an estimated 1 million Uyghurs and other ethnic Muslims in so-called re-education camps in the remote western province of Xinjiang. The bill directs various U.S. government agencies to prepare reports on China's mistreatment of the Muslim minorities and calls on President Trump to impose sanctions on Chinese officials deemed responsible for the mass detentions, specifically Shen Kuangguo, the ruling Communist Party's chief in Xinjiang. Both pieces of legislation have prompted stern protests from Beijing. Regarding the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, China says it is imposing sanctions on U.S.-based non-governmental organizations. NGOs affected by sanctions include Human Rights Watch, the National Endowment for Democracy, and Freedom House. In response to the Uyghur Act, Beijing's foreign ministry spokesperson told reporters that any nation that seeks to interfere in China's internal affairs will pay a price. So how will Washington's decisions to impose sanctions on Beijing over its policies toward Hong Kong and the Uyghurs affect current trade talks and the overall bilateral relationship? Well, joining us to discuss how these issues intertwine are two distinguished regional analysts. Daniel Kleiman is a senior fellow and director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and that's a policy group based here in Washington, and Dean Cheng. He's Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a think tank also based in Washington. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center here in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Dan Kleiman, I'd like to begin with you. Quickly, how do you characterize the Hong Kong democracy movement now after the historic district elections and then this recent law signed by the United States?
So I think it's been impressive to see the staying power and the kind of social mobilization that you've seen in Hong Kong. If you look back at 2014, when the Umbrella Movement took place, which was similarly pushing for sustaining Hong Kong's autonomy, you had roughly low turnout in elections after that. I think it was under 50%. And in these most recent elections, you've seen something like about 75% turnout. So overall, rather than kind of causing mass frustration, you've seen this protest movement turn into a bid for electoral power. And admittedly, these kind of local council elections don't have a whole lot of real clout, but it is kind of the first step towards seeing people take what they're doing on the street and turn it into something a little bit more institutionalized. So I see it as a very positive sign in showing that there is real staying power.
How do you see it, Dean Cheng, these elections, the United States siding with the protesters officially through the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act? Do you see staying power? Does this give them a little more leverage?
Certainly the election results suggest that this is going to be a longer-term movement. The real problem is going to be what Beijing does in response. At the end of the day, Beijing still holds the high cards. Hong Kong will revert to full control by 2047. More to the point is, Beijing has already made very clear that, yes, Hong Kong can have elections, Hong Kong can have people in place, but the final decisions increasingly are going to shift to Beijing. We saw this with a recent court case, for example. Carrie Lam wanted to ban face masks. The Hong Kong courts said that was unconstitutional. And Beijing's courts then stepped in and said, no, we, the Chinese court system, are the final arbiters. That's very disturbing.
Back to you, Daniel Kleinman, with respect to China's response, in particular the U.S. Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, since China reacted with several sanctions against U.S. non-governmental organizations like Human Rights Watch, the National Endowment for Democracy and Freedom House. How significant are these sanctions against these organizations?
So what's striking to me is that it seems like China is trying to, despite its rhetoric, segment the human rights conversation and then the ongoing trade negotiations, that most of what China announced in retaliation for the passage of the Hong Kong Democracy and Human Rights Act are fairly symbolic measures. It's very unclear what even sanctioning an organization like the National Endowment for Democracy might even mean. I mean, China could potentially harass some of their members on the ground, but it's not a very strong measure. And the suspending of U.S. warship refueling and visits, again, very symbolic, doesn't interfere with U.S. military operations in a significant way. So it seems pretty clear that China actually wanted to essentially separate out what was happening on Hong Kong with the trade negotiations. And I would say, looking at the signing statement by President Trump, probably a similar perspective from the White House as well, to try to keep these kind of two tracks distinct for now.
How do you see it, Dean Chang? Of course, President Trump was reluctant to sign the bill for fear that it would be interpreted by China as interfering in the trade negotiations. But at the end of the day, he didn't veto. And this was seen as a victory for the United States, for the Congress, for those interested in holding up our democratic ideals. But of course, China reacted with these sanctions. Do you see it the same way as Dan Kleinman, more symbolic than anything else?
I agree with Dan. It's largely symbolic, but it's also useful to keep in mind. The Chinese have been cracking down on foreign NGOs, academic groups, pretty much the full range of visitors for the last several years. We've had harassment of foreign academics, including Americans. So what I think we're going to see is further harassment NGOs and organizations. But I agree that a lot of that will be symbolic. It's really, to borrow a Chinese phrase, killing the chicken to scare the monkey. It is an attempt to basically warn various human rights groups around the world, do not criticize China if you value your staff's freedom.
Well, I think that this Hong Kong democracy movement is here to stay, notwithstanding all of these warnings by Beijing, Dan Kleinman. And as a result of the elections, there are more protests on the streets, peaceful ones, notwithstanding, once again, Beijing's clout. Do you see an opportunity for some kind of a compromise for Carrie Lam's government? She's, of course, the chief executive, to act a little bit more on some of the other demands that the protesters are making. For example, an investigation into police brutality. They withdrew that extradition bill, but again, there are these other demands. Is there room for some kind of movement on that?
I am fairly skeptical. I mean, I fully agree with Dean that at the end of the day, I mean, Carrie Lam is only independent as Beijing will let her. And the amount of decision-making space she has shrunk considerably over the course of these protests. It's pretty clear that Beijing's very much taking a hard line, not wanting to make concessions, sees concessions as likely to further fuel protests and kind of rising demands. And so I don't see Carrie Lam being able to meet demands of the protesters, whether it is investigation into police brutality or trying to restore some of the eroded autonomy that Hong Kong has experienced. I see these protests continuing, maybe turning more and more into sort of an institutional pushback, as we saw in these elections. But I don't, unfortunately, see kind of a brokered way out of this in which all parties come to a kind of reconciliation.
Dean Chang, do you see it the same way that, notwithstanding these victories for the protest movement, the elections, the U.S. bill, I'm sure other countries are supporting the protesters, that this might be an opportunity for some kind of a compromise?
The problem with compromise is both sides have to have mutually attainable goals. From Beijing's perspective, it expects Hong Kong to come to heel. It has accepted no responsibility, no role for the protests. It has ascribed all of it to rising inequality within the territory of Hong Kong. Young people are protesting because they can't afford housing. The people of Hong Kong who are protesting are saying, we want to have more autonomy from Beijing. And from Beijing's perspective, that's simply not possible. That is something that the central government would mean giving up centralized control. So compromise is going to be very hard when the two sides are starting from so opposed positions.
But aren't they just, that is, the protesters and one could say the majority of Hong Kongers, even if they dislike the disruption in the economy and their lives, don't they just want what is their right under the basic law? And in 2047, it's going to be bad enough. And they don't want to see any kind of rights being withheld or repressed before that deadline.
Absolutely. The people of Hong Kong are basically saying China needs to actually follow the basic law. But if we look at what happened with the Umbrella Movement in 2014, the National People's Congress in China passed a white paper that basically said, when we talk about one country, two systems per the basic law, make no mistake, your system is subordinate to ours. Any rights you have are by the generosity, if you will, of Beijing, not by treaty. That, again, is a completely different take on the meaning of the basic law and the rights that are guaranteed under it from what London negotiated back in the 1990s with the Beijing government.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Daniel Kleiman. He's Senior Fellow and Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Dean Cheng, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center. And we're discussing the ramifications of U.S. sanctions on China for its heavy-handed tactics toward the Hong Kong democracy movement. And soon we'll be talking about Beijing's treatment of its minority Uyghur population. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a very loyal listener, Jing Brown from Juba, South Sudan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion, and to you, Daniel Kleiman, let's move on briefly now to the Uyghur question. What's your reaction to the cache of secret documents which shows how Beijing selects Uyghurs for detention and how they are controlled? There's over a million Muslim ethnic Uyghurs that are being detained, and Beijing is saying, well, we need to do that to prevent religious extremism and Islamist extremism. But in reality, they are really being terribly persecuted for, it seems, no other reason than who they are.
I mean, Beijing has been making a very concerted effort to defend the indefensible in Xinjiang. And clearly, I think much of the world understood that what China would call vocational schools were, in fact, detention camps where upwards of a million Uyghurs and others were being interned. I think these documents certainly dispel any lingering doubts that might have been in some countries. Of course, some countries may selectively decide just to ignore the hard evidence. I think what these documents very much shed light on is how systematic this effort has been, that it ultimately traces back to Xi Jinping in terms of his crackdown starting in 2014 on what they considered the threat of terrorism, and very much Xi talking about using all means of dictatorship to take a much harder line than his predecessor. So I think it implicates Xi in a way that we hadn't seen quite as clearly before, which is certainly notable. I think also some of the information that's come to light shows how systematically disruptive these camps are for the people of Xinjiang more generally. I mean, you've seen population growth rates go down significantly, poverty rates go up. And so you see the kind of spillover effects of this. It's much more than a million people in camps. It's millions upon millions of their families being deeply affected as well. And so to me, I think it very much should show the world that China is engaging in practices that we would not tolerate any regime doing, and that we need to really look at this and understand that there is a major ideological component to certainly the vision China has for the 21st century, and that's very different from democracies.
Dean Cheng, what is your reaction to these documents and to the treatment of the Uyghurs by Beijing?
It's fascinating to watch the Chinese combine old and new methods. In the American Declaration of Independence, one of the things that we complained about was that the British king was quartering troops in the homes of American colonists. What we see in Xinjiang is CCP, Chinese Communist Party officials, being housed in the homes of those who have lost family members to the so-called re-education camps. They are literally quartering party officials with the families of those who have been arrested. At the same time, we see these documents talk about the use of algorithms to predict who should be arrested. This is cutting-edge use of artificial intelligence and modern technology. What it really comes down to, in many ways, is that the Chinese seem to be viewing George Orwell's 1984 as an instruction manual. I think Orwell would be pretty horrified at that. But that's what we are seeing with this combination of old tactics and new technologies combined together.
That's really very chilling. Daniel Kleiman, what does the leak say about any kind of internal dissidence within the Communist Party? Are there members or those who are participating in this crackdown who are disturbed by it? And is that significant?
I mean, it's clear from these leaks that there are at least a limited number of perhaps even senior Communist Party officials who are concerned or dissatisfied with the approach. And the fact that you have had document leaks of this kind of magnitude, of this sensitivity, is telling. I mean, for at least from what we've seen thus far, it's clearly a very distinct minority, admittedly a minority that's been willing to take a risk to disseminate these documents beyond China. I think what is striking is that you've had a real, especially in Xinjiang, what these documents have revealed, break from at least a two-track approach, which was cracking down on aspects of the population, but also trying to bolster economic growth, to pretty much only focusing on the first part, the crackdown. And so to me, I mean, it signifies that at least the majority of the Communist Party, as it approaches Xinjiang, is much more willing to forego a kind of economic growth agenda and purely focus on hard power.
And what do you say, Dean Cheng, to the fact that these were leaked by an inside Communist Party official? Is it significant?
When we look at what happened in Tiananmen 30 years ago, a series of documents also leaked out. I think it's important to remember, one, the Chinese bureaucracy is vast, but it is not monolithic. That there are differences of opinion, that there will be people who disagree with top-down decisions. I suspect this has been exacerbated by Xi Jinping's tendency to centralize power to himself and to even further restrict the opportunity for intra-party dissent. Whether or not that will lead to any policy changes, however, is far less clear. I think the most important thing to recognize is that whoever did leak this, really, that took a lot of courage and may well have had devastating consequences. This kind of document leakage, which is rife in Washington, is viewed very, very negatively in Beijing, is the sort of thing that could easily lead to extensive prison sentences or even lethal punishment.
Back to you, Dan Kleiman. Back to U.S. policy. We have now the U.S. Uyghur Act of 2019, which will target those who are seen as a part and parcel of this persecution and these re-education camps. To what extent will this have any kind of impact on Beijing's treatment of the Uyghurs?
I think in the short term, it won't have a highly significant impact, but it certainly will impose a more direct cost on the individuals involved, which is very different than in the past. And so it, at least I think it should give individual senior Communist Party cadres a little bit of pause before they take part in these types of human rights abuses where they will actually face sanctions. I think more generally and perhaps more productively, there are opportunities for the U.S. to look at adding certain Chinese technology companies to the entity list that are involved in human rights abuses in Xinjiang. I think when you look at the companies that are essentially abetting and enabling a lot of the high-tech aspects of repression in Xinjiang, those companies operate in global markets. They do want market share outside China. And in some ways, trying to sanction them or put them on the entities list probably moves the needle a little bit more than trying to punish individual Communist Party officials who are implementing these policies, which is the morally right thing to do, but not on its own going to sort of move the needle.
Dean Cheng, how effective do you think this U.S. Uyghur Act will be in deterring this kind of behavior on the part of Beijing or individuals, companies?
During the Cold War, organizations like Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty broadcast into the countries behind the Iron Curtain. And when the curtain finally came down, Poles, Hungarians, and others said, those broadcasts, those resolutions, President Reagan mentioning them in his speeches, were the sorts of things that gave heart to the locals. It told them they were not forgotten, that the rest of the world knew and cared about what was happening. And I think that that is an important part of this. The other thing to keep in mind is Beijing wants international acceptance and recognition. It is actively trying to place people in international organizations ranging from the World Health Organization to the international organization responsible for guarding intellectual property. Talk about the fox guarding the hen house. These sorts of acts, these sorts of sanctions are an indicator. If you have something to do with Xinjiang, no, you are probably not going to become a senior official at Interpol or even at WHO or any of these other organizations.
But interestingly, Dan Kleiman, has nothing to do with their sense of morality or ethics, right? They just see these types of sanctions as, like Dean said, you know, affecting their ability to place people in international organizations. But it seems as if Beijing doesn't have any qualms about this type of repression in and of itself vis-a-vis this Muslim population that they see perhaps as foreign, notwithstanding they are part and parcel of China's diverse populations.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely notable that China is not living up to even the obligations in its own constitution in terms of how it treats its own citizens broadly, and certainly most especially members of the Uyghur minority. I think, I mean, when you see China using repression in Xinjiang in ways that very much combine kind of both 21st century technology and 20th century, if not earlier, methods, I mean, it speaks to the nature of China's system, which is an autocracy. And I think more and more there's recognition here in the United States and globally that China's regime type matters, that China is not just another kind of state actor in the world, but that its autocracy influences how it treats its own population and how it engages others as well. The autocracy that China practices does incline at least a majority of its leaders to not have these kind of moral qualms in Xinjiang, and I would submit as well in terms of its international engagement, to not necessarily have those kind of moral restrictions that democracies typically have.
Would you agree, Dean Cheng?
Yes. The focus of the Chinese Communist Party is power, retaining it and exploiting it. And the moral aspect is arguably not one that plays a significant role, whether it's in terms of China's international dealings with other countries or its internal dealings with various minority groups.
As we close, back to you, Dan Kleiman, with regard to any kind of effect these bills that the United States has passed vis-a-vis Hong Kong or the Uyghurs and China's retaliation. How's this going to play into the U.S.-China trade talks? Will Mr. Xi make decisions about trade based on China's economic interests at the end of the day?
So first I would say, I mean, these acts that are passing or in process through Congress send a very strong signal not only to China and to the Chinese people, and I think it's important to make that distinction between the Communist Party of China and the Chinese people, but they send a strong signal to American allies and partners as well. Allies and partners that may be democratic, but often fear Chinese economic retaliation, that the U.S. will stand by its values. And I think that does hearten some of our allies and partners who are inclined to do the same. But without kind of U.S. taking the first step, U.S. leadership may not do so. In terms of the kind of trade negotiations and the effect there, my own belief is that both China and the United States government have very much tried to segment these two issue sets. And so I don't necessarily see the acts that are passing Congress to necessarily have a large effect on the trade negotiations. I think both sides are not necessarily eager to actually conclude anything meaningful through 2020. And you'll see both Washington and Beijing continue to hold kind of on-again, off-again talks.
Well, you get the last word, Dean Cheng, with respect to impact on U.S.-China trade and U.S.-China bilateral relations overall.
I think the passing of these bills is an important and powerful reminder to Beijing and to other governments around the world that the United States is not simply led by the president, but that Congress is an important factor and you ignore it at your own risk. Congress has the ability to impose sanctions and, more importantly, to make life very difficult, for example, for Chinese officials. The good news in this regard is that the Chinese, I think, are more focused on the trade aspect and seem to be prepared to limit their response, as Dan said, more symbolically. Whether or not that will lead to a trade agreement, I agree that 2020 may actually be almost optimistic, but Xi can choose to push for a trade agreement regardless of these bills. Or if he doesn't want to, he could use these as an excuse not to sign one at all.
Gentlemen, thank you so much, but I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. Thanking again my guest, Daniel Kleiman. He's Senior Fellow and Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Dean Cheng. He's Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.